Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Dr. Phil Nichols, and we are going to be discussing The Fountains of Paradise by Arthur C. Clarke, which won the 1980 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So hi there, Phil.
Hi, Seth.
And Phil and I, this is many times on the podcast, I am talking to a person for the first time, but in this case, Phil and I have talked a number of times on Take Me to Your Reader when we have discussed Bradbury in adaptation. So, you know, we're old friends.
Yes, indeed.
So why don't we go ahead and talk about you? What do people need to know about you?
Well, I don't think they need to know much about me. The way I describe myself in relation to science fiction things is that I grew up watching science fiction. I was a child of Lost in Space, Time Tunnel, original Star Trek, Batman, all that sort of stuff. So late 60s, early 70s. And only later did I start reading science fiction. And when I did start reading science fiction, it was with Bradbury, first of all. And the very second science fiction book I ever read was an Arthur C. Clarke book, which was a collection of short stories. Yeah. And I think the fact that I was reading Bradbury, who is a short story writer, and Clarke's short stories kind of set me off on this path of being fascinated by the short form rather than novels. I mean, I do read novels, but I prefer short fiction. Mm. So I think those early experiences of reading kind of set me up for that's my thing.
Right. And I know, I mean, we should talk about your podcasts as well, because you have a couple of them. So why don't you mention those?
I do. I have a Bradbury podcast, which is called Bradbury 100. Which was originally set up to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Bradbury, which was, well, the 100th anniversary was last year, but I've carried on with it, albeit on a very slow schedule of late. And then I have a more general podcast, Science Fiction 101, with our mutual friend Colin Kusky, where we talk about all sorts of science fiction, but we tend to favour film and television science fiction, and we tend to favor the classics, I think.
Right, and kind of talking about the preference for short fiction, I know you guys are going to be covering an entire issue of, is it Galaxy magazine?
Yes, that's right, yes. Because I always say to people, you should try and read stories in their original context. You should try and find the context. So like reading Fountains of Paradise for this, published in the late 70s, you've got to put yourself in the mindset of the late 70s in order to fully appreciate the book. So with the same with short fiction. So I thought we should read an old Galaxy. So we're going back 70 years to read a whole issue.
Nice. And I guess we didn't also mention you are a teacher, a professor, right?
Yeah, in the UK, we don't call it a professor. You have to be really esteemed to be called a professor. So I'm just called a senior lecturer. But yes, I teach film in a British university. And I'm also the senior advisor to the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies, which is at Indiana University.
Right. Which is how we originally found you, because Colin was looking around for a possible guest for A Sound of Thunder, if I recall correctly.
That's correct, yes.
That's how we got connected with you, which was fun.
Indeed, yes.
Okay, so why this book, Phil?
Quite frankly, I looked at the list of remaining books that you hadn't covered on this podcast, and I sort of looked at the ones that I was familiar with and the ones that I felt like rereading, and I saw immediately that there was this Clarke book there. And I had read it probably in the early 80s, but I had never reread it. I'd never gone back to it. Unlike many of the others that you've covered on the podcast, sort of the early classics like, Alfred Bester. Can't remember who the other early ones were, but some of those early ones I have revisited over the years, but I never quite got around to Fountains of Paradise. So I saw this as an opportunity to get back there, see if it still works as a book.
Yeah. Well, and there's the British connection as well, right?
Well, yes. I mean, Arthur C. Clarke is probably the UK's greatest science fiction export, although he lived most of his life not in the UK, because he emigrated to Sri Lanka and lived there for decades. And that's where he died, in fact.
And that's somewhat germane to this book on account of it seems to be in a kind of fictionalized Sri Lanka.
Yes, Srikanda, I think he calls it in the book.
Yes. Yep.
A thinly disguised place. In fact, obviously we'll talk about the plot in a minute, but if you look at the kind of afterword in the book, he talks about where he set the book, and he says that for the story to work, he had to move Sri Lanka something like 800 miles south because it isn't actually on the equator.
Right.
But for the book, it needed to be. So he made up this fictional place that is on the equator.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and kick off the non-spoiler discussion of this book? So can you start us with a brief description as spoiler-free as possible? Not that it's really possible with this one.
Yeah. I saw in your notes ahead of doing this, you mentioned doing something of an elevator pitch.
Yes.
And I think ironically, for this, it has to be a space elevator pitch.
I believe so. Yes.
Basically, Fountains of Paradise is a novel which tells the story of the construction of a space elevator. And what that is, essentially, is imagine you've got a geostationary satellite that orbits the Earth once every 24 hours, and the Earth turns once every 24 hours, so the satellite stays at the same fixed point in the sky. Imagine joining the satellite to the Earth with a cable, and then climbing up the cable. Essentially, that's what the space elevator is. It's it's a linkage between Earth and geostationary orbit, up which you go in an elevator or a train. And the book really tells the story of the construction and the constructor of the elevator, and sort of explores what could possibly go wrong.
Yes, definitely.
And that's where the spoilers come in.
Yeah, it is. the space elevator is an interesting concept because I feel like it's become more possible, it seems like, in recent times with developments of carbon nanotubes and graphene and other kinds of materials, because the kind of material you need is something that's quite light and extremely strong, right? Because if you tried to drop a steel cable all the way down from a satellite to the Earth, it wouldn't be able to sustain its own weight and it would snap.
Exactly right. Yeah. So, I mean, I've never read any original research on any of this. All I know about it is what Clark says in this book and also in some essays that he wrote. He talks about the engineering challenge. And when he wrote the book, actually, we didn't have the carbon nanotubes or any of that stuff that you mentioned.
Right.
So I can't remember what the substance is in the book, but he sort of bases it on the technology known to him at the time, but I think he knew that this was not really possible at that point, but it was becoming possible.
Yeah, I think he calls it like a diamond monofilament kind of thing.
I can't remember.
And it's almost analogous to spider's webs, right? Because he even talks about the little spinneret that he has of it that comes in quite handy toward the end of the book.
That's right, yeah. So, as with the spider's web, a very fine material and yet a really very strong material for what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it's constructed from.
Mm-hmm. And when you're going to have a material that's kind of, magical and super, super strong, you have to come up with ways to make it interesting because, of course, it's not infinitely strong. And
that's right.
And so there... the reason that he ends up in Srikanda, and I don't know if this is, it's not really spoilers, but there's several possible places that he could launch this from, that he could tether it to. But Srikanda is the best place. But unfortunately, it's also a holy site for the Buddhists, I believe, of Srikanda.
Yes, that's right. And that allows Clark to do a number of things. I mean, one of them is to return to his fascination with why we have religions.
Yes.
I mean, Clark was an avowed atheist. Mm-hmm. He always said that he used to say he was an agnostic, but then he realized that that was an untenable position. So he called himself an atheist. Right. But he was fascinated by religion and religions and why people believe sort of the irrational, regardless of whether it's a religious-based thing or other irrational things that people believe.
Right.
So he's very fascinated by that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the exploration of that. But it also allows him to anchor this story into a very deep past, because the book really begins way back. I mean, I can't remember whether it's hundreds or thousands of years ago, with these Buddhists who built this temple at mm-hmm. the top of a mountain with this glorious staircase that rises up and these palatial gardens. And that's where the fountains of the title come from.
Right.
So building of this as a holy place, almost as if almost like a way to get to heaven, going to the right. top of this mountain. And then the elevator is the extension of that actually into the heavens.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of a Tower of Babel sort of
yes.
thing.
Yes.
Do you say Babel or Babel in the UK?
I've heard both. I say Babel, personally, but I've heard both.
Nice. Okay, so moving from that into kind of overall thoughts on the book, you said you had read this one previously back in the 80s. How was it on a reread?
To be honest, I found the beginning section of the book very slow going. Because it's mostly in the kind of expositionary mode that Clark tends to use. He puts a lot of exposition in his books. Quite often he'll mix it in with a kind of dramatizing of the story, so it's palatable. But I found with this, because he's talking about events of a long, long time ago, the first few chapters are very exposition-based. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading it, I was thinking, I'm not sure that I can take this. But fortunately, once I got a few chapters in, and it kind of brings us to the present day and it begins to dramatize, then I was hooked. And mm-hmm. in fact, once I reached the midway point, I was really very hooked. And I got through the second half of the book really quickly compared to the first half. Okay. So I think it holds up. I think it does. I just think it's a bit slow going at the beginning. But that might be me not having such an interest in the sort of the ancient right. side of things.
I'm kind of two minds about the beginning chapters, because like you said, it takes a good, 10 chapters to introduce the space elevator at all. Mm-hmm. And he kind of drops you into what the situation is and starts layering in the history of the place. I think it's Taprobani or Taprobani.
Yes.
I can't remember how it's supposed to be pronounced.
I listened to one of the audiobook versions, and it's clearly pronounced as Taprobani there.
Okay.
So I gather that's how it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading it in my head, I think I was saying Taprobani. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, I listened to part of the audiobook as well, and Taprobani was the way he said it. But I actually enjoyed some of those parts about Kalidasa and the rivalry with his brother and that kind of stuff. And so I found those characters more interesting, I think, than the characters that are in the present day story. And that may just be a Clark thing, because he seems to, in the books that I've read, it's all about the story and very little about the characters. It's about the science, something like Rendezvous with Rama. There's not much in the way of characterization to grab onto. If you're not interested in Rama, you're not interested in that book. And it's somewhat similar here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that would also be true of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. One of the criticisms of the film of that was that there are no real characters that you can root for. But that's also true of the book that Clark wrote. Again, full of exposition. It has people in it, but they're not really characters that you care about.
Right. Yeah, you find, I think, with the characters, it's they have one trait that is who they are. There's, what is her name? Duval, I think. Is that right?
Yes, in this book, Duval, yeah.
Yeah. She is a journalist, and that is what you know about her.
Yeah.
And, of course, Vannevar Morgan is the engineer, right?
Yes.
The only sort of slightly complex character, I think, is the, what is his name? The Venerable something.
Yes, I can't remember
Venerable
the names.
Venerable Parakama, yes. Shoam Goldberg. So he's European, I believe, who has kind of emigrated to Sri Kanda and taken on this other, I guess he's converted more or less to Buddhism?
Yeah, I mean, and from his name, you would assume that he's of Jewish heritage.
Yeah.
And there's talk later in the book, and this isn't a spoiler really, I don't think, but there's talk later in the book that he converts to something else.
Yes.
So he's sort of, his defining characteristic is that he is sort of in a quest for religious truth, if you like.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. He's a bit more intriguing, but he's more of a background character, in a way.
And he's a character that's put there to move the plot forward in some way. He's antagonistic toward the idea of starting the, I think they call it the orbital tower rather than the space elevator.
At Taprobani.
We'll talk. That's more for our spoiler discussion, I think. Because there's a major incident that happens. I find this book to be almost a grab bag of ideas, because there's the big idea is the orbital tower / space elevator. But I'm not sure if he just thought there wasn't enough to build the entire novel on. You know, I'm sure you could do a terrific short story or novella about just the space elevator parts. But it felt like he thought he needed to add in a couple of layers. And so he added in the history stuff, which I thought was interesting. And then he also brought in aliens for some reason. And I still can't quite puzzle out why the aliens are there.
Nor can I.
Other than to have them there for the epilogue.
I puzzle over that. And in fact, a few weeks ago, or maybe a couple of months ago, I listened to another podcast where they review various works by Clarke, and they got around to doing Fountains of Paradise, and I remember them puzzling over that section of the book. There's this thing in there called Star Glider, which essentially is a UFO, an alien spaceship, which happens to pass through the solar system and enables humankind to talk to these distant aliens who are like 52 light years away. And I found that fascinating. I mean, it was really the chapter where that first happens, I thought was great. But it doesn't feel like it's part of the same book. It's very weird.
Yeah, I mean, that part of the book is there so that he can do his musing about religions and his theory that the religions of Earth are based on the fact that we have parents. And so looking up to parents has us looking beyond them to a higher power. And I thought that was an interesting idea. You know, I don't resonate with Clarke on his atheism, but I'm always a fan of depictions of religion in science fiction, because I'm always curious to see what will happen. And I'm kind of used to what Clarke thinks about that from Rendezvous with Rama, from especially Childhood's End. You know, the Star Glider is more or less talkative Rama, right? Because Rama comes through and it's just completely inscrutable, right? There's no signals coming from it. We can only learn what we can get into it and figure out where, sorry, spoilers for that book if you haven't read it, where this one, it's extremely talkative and it has some kind of advanced artificial intelligence on it that allows it to sort of converse with us, because it, as it comes through, it already understands and is able to communicate in both English and I think Mandarin in a rudimentary way. And so we're able to send a bunch of information to it and increase its language capacity.
That's right. And I think I may be wrong, but I think that's a unique observation he has there. I mean, there's lots of books that talk about distant civilizations trying to communicate with us and how it's almost impossible to have a conversation, because if they're 50 light years away, that takes 50 years for our message to reach them and then 50 years for it to come to us. So you can't have any kind of conversation. All you can do is, you can do what Clarke does. You can give a load of exposition to the distant aliens and they can give you a load of exposition. But the Star Glider thing in itself is an AI. It is an intelligent, adaptable machine which is able to teach itself from observation. So it listens into radio and TV signals from Earth and is able to understand them through self-teaching. Yeah. And I think that's a fascinating concept. And then, of course, at some point, it sends information back to its host planet. And later on, the host planet will, if it finds a civilization that it's interested in, it will come and visit. That would take a long time to ever happen, you know, thousands of years potentially. But so I think that the whole structure of that is quite fascinating and could well be a book in its own right. But
Right. And like you said, it's hard to puzzle out why that's here in the book, because it doesn't really move the plot forward.
No. Kind of intersects with the story.
Yeah. I think that's the right way to put it, where it kind of just, it's tangential almost to it.
Yeah.
Hey, before we get into spoilers, why don't we talk about a couple of comps for the book? So books that are similar in theme or content. Do you have any?
I actually have a nonfiction book, which it kept reminding me of, which is another one of Clarke's books called Profiles of the Future. which is it's a collection of his essays on sort of science and that sort of thing. And it's the book where he lays out his various laws, you know, Clark's, I can never remember which one is which, but the Clark's first law, Clark's second law, things like, any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. That's one of his laws. But he lays all of these out in Profiles of the Future, which originally was published in the early 60s, but he revised it a couple of times over the years. And there is actually at least one chapter in there which is about space elevators. So while I was reading this novel, I felt the need to go and have a look at that as well and compare the two, the fictional version and then his straightforward scientific explanation.
Nice.
And they dovetail very nicely. So
I'll say for comps on my end, obviously Rendezvous with Rama for some of the similarities with the Starglider. And then there's some bits of Apollo 13 / The Martian where there's some problem solving in space.
Yeah.
And then a more recent one is The Andromeda Evolution, which is a sequel to The Andromeda Strain, but written by Daniel H. Wilson, where there's a space elevator in that book as well.
I didn't know about that aspect of it. I knew that book existed, but I hadn't really twigged that it had a space elevator.
It's a fun one. And Colin and I got to go over, Daniel lives in Portland, and so we got to go over to his house and interview him about it.
Fantastic.
And,
brilliant.
So that's it for comps for me.
There is another book that it compares to, which admittedly I haven't read for decades, so I don't have a fresh sort of memory of it. But in exactly the same year that Fountains of Paradise came out, there was another novel by Charles Sheffield called The Web Between the Worlds. And it's exactly the same concept. It's a space elevator. The story is different, but it's exactly the same concept, to the point that Clark felt the need to point out to people that it was sheer coincidence. He wrote an essay that referred to Sheffield, you know, so very publicly, basically stuck up for this other guy and said, look, this is not plagiarism. You may have heard of me and not have heard of Charles Sheffield, but believe me, it's a coincidence. So he's very gracious about that, whereas some other writers might have got uptight about their ideas being stolen. But it was pure coincidence.
Interesting.
The other general category that this book reminds me of is all those books that deal with first contact. So Carl Sagan's Contact, Childhood's End, the earlier Arthur C. Clarke novel, and those sort of things.
I think Childhood's End is still my favorite of Clarke's books that I've read, although I haven't read that many of them. I haven't read most of the 2001 series. I think I read 2001 and 2010, but... not too many others.
I of all the ones I've read, I think Childhood's End is probably the best. Although I think I now like 2001 better. It's not to say that it's a better book.
You recently revisited that one, right?
Yeah. And I think I've spent most of the last umpteen decades thinking that 2001 is not important as a book because the film is what matters and the book is just a side project. But actually rereading it recently, I came to realize it's actually quite a decent book. Even if the film had never existed, it would have been a decent book in its own right.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and go into spoilers? So anything you want to talk about, any themes, plot points that we haven't already discussed or we can discuss in greater detail?
Yeah, well, I'm going to go straight for the jugular, which is that the book is divided up into sections. Obviously, there are chapters, but it's also divided up into sections. And there is one distinct section. I've forgotten what it's called, but there is a distinct section where we get into the actual business of the book, which is where things go wrong.
Right.
So we've got the space elevator and there is a disaster which has to be averted. And as soon as we get to that, it really comes to life as a dramatized story. And that's where it really feels like Andy Weir. It's the same sort of thing as The Martian. There's a problem for which there has to be a technological engineering solution if only our hero is clever enough to figure it out. And of course he is, and they do. I mean, the detail of the The fault is that in order to use this space elevator, of course, you need to be able to ride from the ground all the way up to geostationary orbit. There are some way stations that you can stop off at. So if people need to change vehicles, or if they don't want to make the whole trip, they can get on another vehicle and come back down.
Right. Or if they're tourists and just want to see the view.
Absolutely, yes. And that's referred to in the book, isn't it? Some travelers, they keep comparing it to a bridge, a fictional bridge built between Gibraltar and the north of Africa,
right,
which is the previous project of the hero of the book. And they talk about, I think the majority of people driving across that bridge do it so that they can say they've driven across the bridge. It's not because they want to get anywhere. It's the sheer experience of it. But what happens in the final section of the book is that the main elevator becomes stuck because something goes wrong, the detail of which I can't remember and I don't think is important, but it's kind of stuck and cannot move under its own power. So what do you do? Do you send somebody down to rescue them from above, or do you send somebody up to rescue them from below? And quite how do you do that?
Yes, and unfortunately, the station above them is so far away that they won't get there in time, right?
That's right, yeah. So the only way is to go from below.
Yeah, and I believe it was essentially a disaster where it was a professor and his students who were going up to study the sun because they suspected that the sun was doing something like it did in the movie Sunshine, where it was beginning to vary in its output, which, of course, you find out at the end of the book was completely true. They were right about that. And basically, they get to that, I think it was Midway Station, is that right? Or
yeah, I think so, yeah.
And then something blows up. And they, you know, they're lucky to escape with their lives, but now they're here. They are stranded between heaven and earth, as he compares it to Muhammad's tomb in the book. And yeah, it's a little telegraphed, you know, a little bit of Chekhov's gun in there because Morgan is not terribly well. He's, you know, he's a high stress individual. I think he's only in his 60s, but he has some heart trouble, and so he has this monitor called Cora, I think.
Mm. That's right.
And
yeah.
And you know, as soon as he gets that it's going to be important.
It absolutely is, isn't it? It's, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a pacemaker in the way it's fitted to him. But so this is one of Clark's genius ideas, that it's a pacemaker that talks. So it kind of tells you, it nags you, basically.
Yes. You need to rest for 30 minutes.
That's right. And then also, if you should actually have a heart attack, Cora then starts shouting out, "Help, help, is there anyone here who can help?"
Right. not with any wireless communication of any kind, just loud.
Oh, no.
That's one of the fun things about the retro future, right? Where someone is projecting from 1979 into, I don't know, 2150s, I think, in this book. I can't remember how far in the future it was. Maybe it was only the 2060s. But, you know, completely missing cell phones and other wireless communication.
Absolutely.
But hitting on a couple of other things, which I thought, you know, there was something in there that was kind of social media-ish, where you could subscribe to news services.
Absolutely. I made a note here. I'm just looking at the actual words I used. Clark has invented Google Alerts.
Yes, pretty much.
Because he basically says you can type in any keywords that are of interest to you. You also have to put your name in there so it knows who to send the information to.
Right,
but
right.
This sort of global computer networks. And of course, he's probably picturing these as the computers as filling an entire room. Even though this was written in the late 70s.
Yeah, very much. I believe it's called Aristotle, right?
Oh, yes, it is. I forgot
the big
that.
Mainframe.
Yeah, yes.
And by the way, the sections of the book, it's the palace, the temple, the bell, the tower, and Ascension. And I believe Ascension is the one where all the action happens at the end of the book.
Yeah, yeah. What I realized about that end section is I'm not recommending anyone does this, but if you started reading at that point, so if you ignored all the build-up and you just started reading at that point, I think you would have essentially a very good 1940s Astounding Stories kind of science fiction. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's one of those where there's a disaster, there's innocent people are trapped, and we need a rugged hero to go and solve them using solve the puzzle with their ingenuity. So that last section very much is the roots of Clarke's writing, because that's how he started his career. But all the stuff before it is where he shows off his literary prowess, if you like, or not.
Yeah, as the case I did want to talk about that, because I think in the episode that I did on Rendezvous with Rama, we talked about it as and saying, you know, this doesn't feel like a book that was written in that time. It felt like it was written 20 years before. And there's definitely parts of this book where I feel like, 1979, really? I mean, it felt more like 1959 in some of those places.
Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. But I think where this is better than Rendezvous with Rama is that it has got, it's about something, you know, it's about these religious ideas. It's about, I don't think Clarke comes out and says this, but it's kind of about us leaving something on our planet, which, might be a signature of our civilization. In many millennia, you know, just as we can go and look at old ruins now and we can figure out what the Egyptians were about from the pyramids and the burial chambers and all of that. And it's as if the space elevator is our civilization's pinnacle of achievement.
Right.
And I think the first time I read the book, I kind of expected there not to be any human civilization by the end of the book. I thought he would take us like a couple of thousand years into the future, but he doesn't quite do that. But maybe the Starglider thing is an equivalent of that. I'm not sure.
Right. I mean, the epilogue jumps forward a couple of thousand years to where there's no humans on Earth, but there's the notion that they will eventually come back to Earth.
Yes.
Because, and I'm not even sure where they are. Does it even say?
No, but throughout the book, it's quite clear that there are human colonies on all the planets.
Yeah.
So,
that's right. Because it mentioned that because of the reduced output from the sun, they were able to colonize Venus.
Yes.
Because with less input from the sun, you could get the greenhouse situation under control on Venus and possibly terraform it, which would be a project for centuries, I'm sure.
Of course, yeah. But they also, Mars figures in the story as well.
Yes.
And there's at one point the Martian government or whatever it is tries to persuade our hero to build his space elevator on Mars, which is actually easier to do because there's less gravity, doesn't need to be as big, and so
on. Not the potential for it as intense of storms because of the lower air pressure.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, this I don't think is spelled out very well in the book, but it is spelled out in Clarke's essay about space elevators. And that is that, I mean, the idea of a space elevator in itself isn't that interesting. You just go up to geostationary orbit. What are you going to do when you get there? Mm-hmm. But what you can do is you can use the space elevator as a kind of a slingshot to fling things out into space. If you build the elevator longer than it needs to be, and that the final section is a flexible piece, it will actually swing out into space due to the rotation of the Earth. And you can attach payloads to the end of it, and they can be flung out into space. So you don't need to use rockets. And that, I assume, I don't think he joins all the dots. I think he leaves it to us as readers to do this. But I think he's assuming that because we've got colonies on all the planets, this will be a utilitarian function of the space elevator is to launch these payloads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he definitely talks about that. And, you know, like you said, the benefit is right now, if we want to get something into orbit, we have to use chemical rockets in order to overcome the gravitation. And we have to, you know, there's a reason that people launch from Cape Canaveral because of where it's positioned and the relative velocities and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Where with a space elevator, once you're up to the top of it, you're already at quite a substantial speed. And so you can launch something out of there and you're not having to deal with the gravitation of the Earth, not even taking into account any flexible slingshot kind of effects. There's a major benefit to that. And he talks about it in the book that I think he says it would be something like $20 per ton to get stuff into orbit with the elevator, where I looked it up recently. It was something like $11,000 per kilogram right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a major, major benefit.
Yeah.
So one thing that, I mean, like you mentioned, I think I do kind of want to talk about if you were to adapt this, how much of it would you adapt? You could just adapt the disaster portion and the rescue and have a pretty exciting hour of television. And you could probably stretch it a little bit because one thing after another goes wrong, right?
Yeah.
where he, because in the, I think even before getting the elevator going, they had these vehicles that they called spiders for making the ascent for during construction. And that was kind of the first proof of concept when he sent up the journalist.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? When people first started sending things into space, they sent monkeys and dogs. But with the space elevator, right. No, you stick a journalist on there and send them up on their own.
Right. Good luck. Well, and of course, Morgan himself had wanted to be the first one to go up just for selfish ambition reasons, I'm sure, which you can understand.
Yes, that makes sense.
Because he's, to the extent that there's characterization of him, it's that he's extremely tunnel vision focused, not interested in relationships with people, just it's all about the science. He's not having children. I think he interacts with a nephew at one point and kind of muses that he never had any children of his own, but that the orbital tower would outlive him. So
So in terms of what you do with this, if you make this into a film or any other medium, I think Hollywood would be drawn to the disaster aspect. I mean, it's got all of the elements of, I don't know, Towering Inferno or Titanic or any of those. Yeah, it's got all of that. It's also got great opportunities for CGI work. I mean, actually showing the thing being constructed, I can kind of imagine all sorts of visual ways that could be brought to life in a really innovative way. I mean, Clark describes some of the things like you look up at this tower and you can see that it goes off to infinity, but you can't see the top of it. And I can imagine having a camera that kind of travels all the way up so that we really get that brought to life for us. In terms of the rest of the story, I think the ancient civilization that owns the mountain, I think that would be a very powerful visual in the film as well. So I can see that being used. I think there's quite a lot of it that could make for a good film. But what it is lacking is the human element. It hasn't really got human relationships in there. Yeah. Not that I particularly want them, because I think there's enough in there as a book to keep me amused. But I just know that there's certain things that Hollywood always does, and it would only be Hollywood that would be interested in adapting this. It's not the sort of thing that could be done independently on a low budget, really. So it would end up being a love story. I can just see
he and the journalist are connected to each other in some way.
Maybe the professor would be a female professor, and the engineer would be Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise, anyone named Tom, basically.
Tom Hardy, there we go.
There's another one. So, I can see that this could make a decent film. Unlike Rendezvous with Rama, which I don't think would make a good film at all, because it is...
You'd have to add on a lot of stuff to engage people other than the visuals.
Exactly. But I think this has, it's got it. I think it's got all of those elements. But I'm not sure where the interest would come from in somebody reading this book and then seeing this as a movie. Unlike The Martian. I mean, The Martian also is to do with engineering solutions to problems, but because of the way it's told, you can imagine anybody picking up that book and becoming engaged in that main character. Yes. And if you're an actor and you read it, you'll think, my God, I have to play this character.
Yes.
I don't think you get that with Fountains of Paradise, because it's third person narration. It's very detached narration, really, because that's what Clark does. He's got a very distant voice in his novels.
Mm-hmm. So one of the fun twists in the book is, of course, there's a legal battle over being able to build out from this mountain, right, in Srikhanda. And he loses the legal battle and gets fired from his job, Morgan does, because of trying to take it on. But there's a legend that these particular butterflies in the area, if they ever reach the top of the mountain, which of course they can't normally do because it's too high up and they can't do it, then that will be Kalidasa returning to his throne. right? And then the people who live there will just throw up their hands and say, oh, well, I guess now we need to leave. And yeah. So when, like you mentioned earlier, the Martians are telling him, hey, do a smaller scale project first. And at mm-hmm. first they're thinking of doing it on Mars, and they end up trying to do it on Earth. Mm-hmm. And this guy, the venerable Parakama, I think his name is connected in some way with the weather service that controls monsoons, right? Monsoon control. Yeah. And because that's one thing that you would think about in that area, he decides to slip the project to Mickey and cause a big storm, which he succeeds in doing. And it hurts the project. It breaks the tether. But it also blows the butterflies up onto the mountain. And yeah. So they just, everybody packs up and leaves. And I think it's very convenient, but it was funny, I thought.
Yeah. And I've got mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I think it's very deftly handled mm-hmm. to have something. I mean, it's quite common in sort of disaster stories to have random occurrences piling on top of random occurrences. But what happens there, as you say, is that the monsoon control is used in order to advance something, but it has a spin-off, an unrelated spin-off.
Right.
Which also advances the project in a sort of totally unforeseen way. So I thought that was quite cleverly done. And it mm-hmm. reminded me a bit of some of the twists and turns that you get in Michael Crichton's fiction, where,
yes.
Again, you get random occurrences, but there's always this kind of cascade effect. And what they didn't realize is there's always that kind of aspect to it. But then Clark also ties it to this problem he's set up of how do you get these religious people off the mountain so that we can use it, which is essentially what they want to do. And as you say, that's very convenient. But I think Clark is being incredibly naive about how religions respond to that kind of revelation. You know, many religions have prophecies, and the prophecy may come true, but there will be debate over whether it did come true or whether it didn't. And then what typically happens is that a religious faction will split. And that's why, you know, we have Jews and we have Christians. They come from the same core belief, but one branch of the divide believed a thing that happened and the other branch didn't. So in the real world, I don't think all of those monks would come down off the mountain. I think some of them would, thinking that their prophecy had been fulfilled, and the others wouldn't, because they would deny that the prophecy had been fulfilled. And so I think Clark is being a bit naive there. But it reminds me of an old short story of his called The 9 Billion Names of God, which is about a similar kind of religious order. Who believe that there is a finite number of ways of naming God. And once all of those ways have been found and have been spelled out, then the world comes to an end. So there's a couple of computer scientists who go there and build this massive computer, because this is the 1940s, build a massive computer for this religious order to compute all the combinations of all the characters of their alphabet, thus figuring out all the possible names of God. And they do it, and the engineers leave the computer running and go back down the mountain. And when they're halfway down, I think it's something like the stars start going out and they realize that, oh my God, we've just brought about the end of the world.
Right. That's one I've actually read. I mean, I've been on another podcast talking about Childhood's End. You know, Clark has some musings in that book about the death of religion as a result of the overseers, overlords, what they revealed. And I said on the podcast, I said, I feel like there would be a substantial portion of religious people who would say, hey, not only is this not a problem for our faith, but our sacred text absolutely predicted all of this.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a religious person, I'm self-aware enough to know that's the way it would go with a substantial section of the religious populace.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even moving away from religion, we're seeing that very much in through the pandemic, that the majority of people, the vast majority of people accept this is a global pandemic. we need vaccines, blah, blah, blah. But then you've got a minority who will swear blind that there is no pandemic. This is all fabricated, you know. Right. So even if there's no religion involved, it is in human nature for some people to believe a thing and for others to deny that thing, right, even though it's staring them in the face.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. And it's, you get into motivated reasoning, right? Where I have some friends on social media who decided that the vaccines, for instance, are evil because they were developed using fetal stem cell lines. Mm-hmm. And so because they think the vaccine is evil, they will believe anything that is spoken against it.
Yeah.
And so I see things about, you know, thousands of people are dying because of the vaccines and the government is covering it up. And I just think, I can't believe in that kind of conspiratorial thinking that could really take place. But that's just me. There's a local Pacific Northwest connection in this book because the Tacoma Narrows Bridge is discussed a number of times. And it's one of those things that if you're an engineer, you know, in engineering school, everybody who studies mechanical engineering of any kind will see the video of the bridge flying to pieces because it's not far away from here. But the power of resonance frequencies, and that is, of course, you know, germane to the discussion of the Gibraltar Bridge, and then of course to the orbital tower as well, because you have to be concerned about winds and other forces building up a resonance cascade and causing a problem.
And those, from the engineering point of view, those are some of the nicest parts of the book, I think. I can't remember how it comes up, but there's talk of somebody tapping on the elevator and kind of expecting to hear the sound of it. And he says, well, you won't really hear anything because it's going to take several hours for the sound waves to travel from one end of the tower to the other and back again before you'll get any movement in the tower.
Yeah.
Plus, he talks about either the tower itself or the elevators having to be able to adapt to the movements, the inevitable movements in the tower.
Mm-hmm. To damp the movement.
Yeah, that's right. Because it can't be a rigid structure any more than a long bridge across a really large river can be a rigid structure. It has to have flexibility. And of course, the flexibility is both the strength of it because it can survive crosswinds, but it's the weakness of it because, as you say, you can have resonances. And what I like in the book is that Clark does make these parallels to things that we are familiar with. So he talks, as you say, about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. He talks about the laying of the transatlantic telegraph cables in the 1800s, which is a similar kind of thing in that people had to make cables that were hundreds or thousands of miles long. How on earth do you do that? You know, and they paid them out from the back end of a ship. And quite often it didn't work. The cable would snap and they'd have to start again or splice two bits together. So it's his knowledge of previous technologies that shines through in the book. None of it is written from a naive point of view. I think his understanding of human behavior is a little bit naive in places. But the engineering stuff, he's got a very deep understanding.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can tell that in his writing, that he comes at it from a science background.
Yeah.
I did find it, even though, you know, I don't agree with, there's the beginning of one of the chapters is a bunch of sort of smug prognostications against religions, which I mean, I found it interesting, but I was just kind of like, okay, here we go, Clark. This is par for the course with him. I did like, though, that Starglider was unable to determine differences between religious festivities and sporting events and art festivals and those kind of things. And I thought, okay, that is accurate, especially, you know, like if you go to a church, most places in the United States on Sundays, you'll see at least one person wearing the local team's football jersey. So I feel like he was right on about that.
Yeah, I think he's very perceptive in a lot of things. There's a philosophical angle to the book. There's the historical angle. I mean, he's clearly very fascinated by the ancient Sri Lankan culture, I mean, obviously it's fictionalized here because the whole setting of the book is fictionalized, but it's very clearly based on a real thing. And I just this morning I was looking at a web page which has some photos of the mountain that's referred to, and when you see the images of the real place that's being alluded to, it's incredibly impressive. And you see the steps, you know, the stairs that have been built up, and you can absolutely see what inspired him to include those historical angles. And he somewhere, I think it's in the afterword to the novel, he talks about having flown over the mountain in real life in a helicopter. Mm. So, you know, he'd had that view from above, if you like. I think that was after he'd written the novel. But clearly he has a deep fascination for that. Many people, when they go and live in another country, they don't adapt to the local culture. But he absolutely immersed himself in Sri Lankan culture and was a very revered figure, from what I understand, because he was a famous writer, famous scientist, a famous spokesperson for science. And Sri Lanka was very proud of him, from what I understand.
Thinking about the mountain and the, you know, there's a pilgrimage that's done, of course. And at some point, Morgan takes the easy way, right? Not the easy way, because he found it terrifying.
Yes.
which that reminded, I read aloud the passage where he was talking about that he wished that the driver would pay more attention to the turns that in the road. When we went to Israel a few years ago, we took the bus from Tel Aviv all the way down to Eilat down on the Red Sea at the very south end of the country. And there were a few times where my wife was like, you should be thankful you were asleep for that part, because it was terrifying, because the bus driver was carrying on a conversation with two or three other people on these narrow winding roads. And but the other thing was the shrine and the ascent to it reminded me of when we went to Japan years ago on the island of Shikoku, which is the most rural of the main islands of Japan. It's the one where you get as little help as an English speaker there of any place else on the main islands. But there is I think the city is Kotohira. There's a shrine that's at the top of something like 1400 steps. And the steps it starts off as basically a pedestrian road. And so, you know, you'll take one step every, I don't know, you'll step up once every, I don't know, 100 meters or something. And then eventually you start to get into the hundreds of steps at a time, or dozens of steps at a time, at any rate. And then you finally get up there and it's this tiny little unimpressive shrine. But it's about the journey, right? Not the destination. Yeah. But in this case, in the book, I feel like the destination would really be something.
Yeah. It really sounds like that. And actually, that something else I was reminded of, and I meant to look it up, but I didn't get around to looking it up. I seem to recall that in recent times, there's been an attempt to build a telescope, an observatory, on, I think, one of the Hawaiian islands. And it was opposed because it is sacred ground or something.
Right.
Do you know about that?
That's on the main island, the big island of Hawaii. Yeah. And there's already an observatory there. That's the crazy thing, is they're not building something brand new. They're just, I believe they're replacing one of them.
Ah, okay.
Because you do get to an elevation at which you have to deal with less of atmospheric disturbances. Mm-hmm. And that's why I looked this up. We were just in Hawaii a couple of months ago, and I noticed that all of the streetlights are very yellow, almost orange. Mm. And I looked it up, and it's because of the observatories, because the normal street lamp frequency of light is disturbing to, there's more light pollution, I guess, is what I would say. And so it's because of the observatory that they have all those yellow lamps. And it makes it kind of confusing. When we were there a couple of years ago, on a trip, we had a red rental car, but those lights made it look gray. And so we were standing in front of the car thinking, I think this is where I parked, but this does not look like our car. And I was clicking the clicker and I'm like, yeah, I guess that's it. So, but yeah. What else, Phil? I think I've come to the end of my notes. And hopefully nobody can detect that we've had several interruptions because it's very windy in the Portland area and I've lost power.
Yeah, well, I blame the monsoon people, you know,
who
control the monsoons.
Exactly.
Very minor thing, but we were talking about characterization and Clark's lack of interest in the same.
Yes.
I think, I get the impression that he sees the naming of characters as being part of their characterization. And so the main character, as you mentioned at the beginning, is Vannevar Morgan. Now, that's a very unusual name. I've never met a single Vannevar in my life. I don't think I knew this when I first read the book back in the 80s, but rereading it this time, as soon as I saw the name Vannevar, I knew this must be a reference to Vannevar Bush, who I don't know if he's known to you, but he was a sort of a leading science figure in the early 20th century. Mm. One of the people responsible for getting the Manhattan Project off the ground in terms of convincing the president to go ahead with that. And he also he invented a thing called Memex, which is a concept rather than a product. But essentially what Vannevar Bush did was realize that you could organize information not in the hierarchical way that you do in a filing cabinet, but you could tag pieces of information in order that you could search them in a more oblique way. So the whole kind of basis of how we search on computers today.
Right. Indexing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That whole concept was worked out theoretically before computers really were even able to do that. And it was Vannevar Bush that did it. So Clark would have known that name, undoubtedly. And I wouldn't mind betting that he probably knew Vannevar Bush personally, because he seems to have known all of these great scientists. So I just think that's probably part of the characterization from Clark's point of view, is to make you think of this earlier Vannevar figure. But of course, it only works if you've heard of the earlier one.
I just assumed it was a made-up name. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. I've got a really trivial note here. On page 138 of the edition that I was reading, there's a little equation, which is Euler's theorem. Mm-hmm. And there's a typo. It's wrong in the book.
Oh, really?
It says E, in the version I've got, it says E plus 1 equals 0, which is not right. It's supposed to be E to the power of I pi plus 1 equals 0. It just made me laugh. And when I was listening to the audio book, which is not Clark reading it, but an actor reading it, that also is wrong. And it made me wonder, has that mistake been there in all editions of the book? So that's something I'm going to try and find out later. I'm going to try and find some other copies of the book.
Interesting.
There's one other thing. In chapter 34 of the book, again, this is just a random note that I made, but Clark says something like, much of the 21st century was about people learning to live with the Golgotha virus. And I thought, oh my God, he knew about coronavirus, but he just called it something else. But it's just one of those things. It's like a list of historical challenges to the human race, if you like. Mm-hmm. And one of them was learning to live with this virus.
I mean, there's a religious reference in there, obviously, because the Golgotha is the place listed in the Bible where the crucifixion took place.
So, yes.
The place of the skull, it was called.
Ah, interesting. Huh. Yeah. So I think that's typical of Clark. I mean, I think you have these kind of references are often just thrown in and dropped in. And whether he's doing it to impress, which some of them he might be trying to show how clever he is. But I think more often than not, it's to try and weave a much richer tapestry than you would get just from the characters interacting.
Yeah. Well, I have come to the end of my notes, and I believe you've come to the end of yours. Is that correct?
I think I have, yes.
Okay. So why don't we move into final thoughts? This one, for me, it's not going to be in the top half of the winners for me. I think I mentioned before that I enjoyed this one more than Rendezvous with Rama. And I will say it's a pretty easy read. And once you get past the kind of initial chapters of it and it starts feeling more like a science fiction book, it becomes more interesting. Once the space elevator is in view, it's an engaging read. It's not amazing characterization. So if you're the kind of person who prefers that in your books, this one probably you might not like. But if you're a nuts and bolts hard science fiction person, there's a lot to chew on here.
And I completely agree with everything you've said there. I think if you've never read any Clark, this is probably a good one to start with, because I think it is a richer bit of storytelling than many of his other novels. But if you're looking for the best of Clark, if you only ever want to read one Clark book, then probably you want to go for Childhood's End, because it is a kind of a groundbreaking book, and very much of its time, but timeless. Whereas I think some of the things in this book that we're talking about do tie it very much to the late 70s and the early 80s.
One thing I forgot to mention was this book mentions contract marriages, short-term contract marriages, which is something that I can't remember if he talked about that in Rondo with Rama or Childhood's End, but I know in a couple of his other books he's mentioned that. Just a little hobby horse of his, I guess.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but he was married for a very brief period back in the 50s. So I think he's speaking from bitter experience.
Yeah, could be. Well, Phil, I really want to thank you for doing this. It's always fun to talk to you. This is the first time, and it's not the first time I've talked to you about something other than Bradbury, because you were nice enough to have me on Science Fiction 101 so I could give you an absolutely diabolical quiz.
Yeah, I was tempted to come on here with some quiz questions, but I thought, no, that's not the format.
Yeah, I know that this is something that you guys do on SF 101, and Colin is like, so I'm plotting how to get back at Phil for his most recent quiz, which was an easier one, right? It was more in the wheelhouse because it was about adapted science fiction.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to figure out how he can really zing you with some stuff that you should know. But I told him, hey, play test it on me, and then Phil can feel good about how much better he does on it than I do. So where can people find you, Phil?
Well, if you want to find the podcasts, just search on your podcast app for Science Fiction 101 or Bradbury 100. Or if you want to find out everything that I do, the best place to go is to my website, which is bradburymedia.co.uk.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you again, Phil.
Thank you.
Always great talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
It's good fun. I look forward to hearing the finished piece.
Yes. All right. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Phil. He's always a pleasure to talk to. I do invite you, if you are not a listener, to Take Me to Your Reader. I would encourage you to go listen to our episodes with Phil, because he brings great knowledge about Bradbury to those podcasts. We did episodes on A Sound of Thunder and Fahrenheit 451, of course, and we also did one for the newer adaptation of Fahrenheit 451, and we also talked about The Illustrated Man. So I encourage you to check out those episodes. Also, you should check out Science Fiction 101. He and Colin are doing great stuff there, and Bradbury 100 is fantastic. He has interviews with a bunch of different people. Really, really great content there if you're interested in Ray Bradbury. So definitely check that out. So, as always, thank you so much for listening. And if you'd like to support the show, you can retweet the episode, you can leave a review, and wherever you listen to the podcast, shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or find me on Twitter @hugospodcast and say hello. It's always nice to hear from people and find out how they discovered the podcast. And of course, if you would like to support the podcast financially, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support there, and I appreciate that. As I'm recording this, the Hugo Awards were just announced, so I have another title to add to the list. I also want to say congratulations to Hugo Girl for making the long list, not quite making the short list this year. I also made the long list, not quite as far up as Hugo Girl, but I want to thank everybody who nominated this podcast. Really, really appreciate that. So next year, let's make sure we marshal all our votes and push Hugo Girl up onto the short list. I'd love to see that. And I think that about does it for this episode. So thank you again so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.